The following program is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston, says you. A game of bluff and bluster, words and whimsy. Now, join our panelists and your host, Richard Schur.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the Ragana Bar at the Charles Hotel in the middle of Harvard Square for Says You, a simple game with words played by two teams, the first of which sits stereo right. Not just another pretty face, Barry Nolan. She's in it for the long haul, but sick of the heavy lifting, Francine Akbar. And attorneys may come and attorneys may go, but he's not just another flash in the pan, Mr. Fletcher, Flash Wiley. Led by?
I'll do the honors.
You'll finally step to the plate. To my left, team two. Consumed with doubt, gripped with emotion, clogged just below the lint trap, Arnie Reisman. From CBS Boston, waiting for her ship to come in and hoping it's not just another tramp steamer, Paula Lyons. And columnist critic, she went to Sarah Lawrence and wound up studying Sarah Lee, Miss Carolyn Faye Fox. Captain, fine.
Mrs. Lintrap.
Mrs. Lintrap.
Mrs. Lintrap. Our game is played in five rounds. Correct answers are worth 10 points or whatever fraction thereof deemed appropriate. We always advise new listeners to grab a pen and paper. Let's begin. We take an opportunity today to review judicially. Please define the following terms from the practice of common law or the common practice of law. Carolyn.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me all you know about the maintenance of an attractive nuisance.
I can tell you that it takes a lot of maintenance to be an attractive nuisance. You want all the details?
You asked for that.
An attractive nuisance is an item that might attract somebody who might get hurt and therefore you might be liable. So you want to protect your attractive nuisance. For example, if you have a swimming pool in your backyard, you need to have a fence around it that's of a certain height and of a certain protective nature so that kids can't wander by and be irresistibly drawn to the dangerous waters within your pool.
And you have to make that fence.
And sue you for everything you've got.
Right, and you have to make that fence high enough so that they don't climb over it, because if they do climb over it, you could still be held liable. That is the maintenance of an attractive nuisance. The fences around a swimming pool, people who have on their premises something attractive to children but also inherently dangerous must take reasonable care to prevent harm, even if they trespass. Flash, since you are the attorney, I save this one for you.
This is pressure.
I asked four attorneys this question. No one knew it.
Okay.
What can you tell me about the term frolic and detour?
That's what you do around an attractive nuisance.
I'll go with that.
Yeah.
Frolic.
I ask four attorneys this at all levels, and no one knows frolic and detour.
Frolic and detour. Well, first of all, I want to say this. There's a reason why none of the attorneys knew it, because it was not a principle that was taught to us in law school. Having said that,
it has to do with what someone is doing. Are they detouring or are they frolicking?
Okay. Okay.
There you go, laid right out for
there
you.
There it is. Okay, now I get it. Yeah.
If it's about what they're doing, is a frolic is a moment off of the principal endeavor that is engaged in for fun, and detour is a moment off of the principal endeavor that is engaged in because the normal way is blocked.
It's like a frolic, an accidental trespass.
You may think that's the worst thing you ever heard.
He's almost got it.
But it's good enough for 10 points. Yeah. Yes, very good. A frolic, there is a distinction between a frolic and a detour. Generally, an employer can often be held responsible for an employee's liability on the job. If someone you hire to drive has an accident, you can be held liable, unless it can be determined that the employee was on a frolic.
Wow.
Not on a simple detour like lunch. Wow. The action occurred.
Wow.
Arnie, tell me what you know about reckless endangerment.
Reckless endangerment. That's when you're endangering people recklessly. That's when you're taking no precautions and you care not a whit about your about anyone else's safety. And
there is a very concrete example of this that comes right from our own backyard.
Right in our backyard, there is an example.
Any thoughts from the other side?
It's not an old case.
Isn't it one of the things you're leaving out is that it is reasonably foreseeable that the consequences of your action
would
harm someone else?
That's right.
The prime example of this actually is the Coconut Grove fire, the horrible tragedy in Boston.
Okay. The door's locked.
It is a harmful act concerted under such circumstances that a reasonable and prudent person would have foreseen the risk of harm. The Coconut Grove fire was the first case in which the owner of the club was convicted of homicide despite his complete lack of intent, but he should have known. Francine, vicarious liability.
Well, when you
I just think it sounds so delightful.
It does. Bring it up. All of these. Liable for something that you didn't cause directly.
That's exactly right. An example that you might have?
Driving a getaway car.
You're driving with your boyfriend and you're tickling him.
And he has a car accident. Oh,
that's what I call vicarious liability, boy.
I like it.
10 points, if ever I heard it.
Isn't that reckless endangerment?
Yeah. It's also a frolic and detour.
Point of law, Francine?
If your chauffeur bangs into someone, you can pay.
That wasn't the example I gave, but all right.
Paula, let's have a little discussion about negligence. What constitutes negligence?
In product liability, negligence can be interpreted as of a company knowing about a hazard of its product and not warning the public about it, such as an ingredient in a prescription drug that they now know can cause death and failure to warn.
Failure to take into account
obvious danger in the design of a product.
Failure to notify.
Spoken as only a consumer advocate could, but 10 points because you
failure to exercise due care.
Failure to do something you should have done, or failure because you did something you shouldn't have done.
That's true. It does work. The door swings both ways. It is failure to do what a reasonable, careful, and conscientious person is expected to do.
But, of course, that never happens in our society. Thank goodness.
Yes. And finally, Barry, the hardest one of them all. Again, I asked 4 lawyers this. Not one of them knew the answer. The doctrine of stale demand.
Stale demand?
The doctrine of stale demand.
You may not know this, but you really should.
Stale?
The doctrine of stale demand. Well, stale demand would be when you had requested something be delivered to you or that you wish to purchase something, and an exceedingly long time has passed since you requested that.
I'm going to put an end to this right now.
Okay, that's not even close.
That's not it?
It is also called, I believe it's laches, L-A-C-H-E-S.
Latches.
Latches.
I know the term, but not the meaning. I believe latches means that you are precluded from raising a right because a reasonable time has elapsed from which you could raise that right. And so the right in and of itself lapses.
Well, when you wish to demand to be made whole.
Well, you just cut it out. You're talking yourself out of 10 points here. Very good. It is actually use it or lose it. It's the doctrine of use it or lose it. If you don't enforce your rights over long periods, they lapse. Okay. Let's go on to round 2, the first of the Says You bluffing rounds, played with a little musical help from our friends, the Mighty Mighty Dactyls. Paula, each of you will receive a card defining a word. Only one will have the actual definition. The other two will have blank cards. Those poor souls will have a few seconds to make up a definition on the spot, good enough to fool Barry's team. 10 points here up for grabs to Barry if he can sniff out the truth, or to you, Paula, if he cannot. A few seconds musically enhanced to come up with a definition for the word propadeutic. P-R-O-P-A-E-D-E-U-T-I-C. Propadeutic. Gentlemen? Our challenge to listeners this week was to create a secondary definition for the word ozone. And among those we loved, Nan Wright of Houston, Texas, thought ozone might be the midpoint of the assembly line at the Alphabet Soup Factory. Yeah, did pretty well on that, Nan.
I like that.
Lenny Josephy of Calgary, Alberta, thought possibly it's the time in between your teacher asking for your homework and your excuse. Ozone. But our winner this week, Michael Morgan of San Diego, California, who suggests that if we look closely at the word, we would obviously see it's the name of the wizard's private jet. Oz won. Oh, perhaps he shouldn't have been the winner. But he is anyway. Congratulations, Michael. A pup is winging westward. Thank you very much. You can enter any of our contests and check out the top entries for any challenge on our website. Just log on to www.sayu.org. That's S-A-Y-S-Y-O-U, all one word. Eggleston, Barnes, McGann, and Farrell. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for giving us a few moments with the word propadeutic. We'll go first to Carolyn. Now behave yourself.
I always do, and I have two definitions.
Uh-huh. But we only need one.
Well, you can pick, can't you? Propadeutic could be a starter class for undergraduates, as in an introductory art lecture called Darkness at Noon, or a chemistry class blowing things up for beginners. Propadeutic could also be an adjective or the practice, the use of religious imagery or themes in a work of art as cover for a subversive idea.
Ooh.
What?
Wow.
Subversive preliminary art class. That's the best combination I could make out of all of that. Arnie, propadeutic.
It's a noun. It's a replacement element in medicine, as when a formula is modified to improve its effect or to create an additional usage for the treatment in diseases.
New and improved.
New and improved.
The new and improved propadeutic. Paula.
How do you say this word again, Richard?
Propadeutic.
Propadeutic, yes. Actually, this is literally before homage or before worship, and it refers to those series of small rituals that are performed in various religions before the central act of worship.
Preliminary rituals. New and improved, or some sort of starting class.
That's
the that is the blankest.
They all actually sound too real. There's usually something so absurd that you can throw it out
in
the bathwater.
Yeah, there's not
water,
much to...
What do you think,
Mayor? I'm not buying Paula this time. I think it's somewhere between the introductory class and the new and improved medicine. And I think that the second definition that Carolyn put in there was designed to throw
use
us off.
Use of religious imagery as cover for subversive ideas or activity?
I'm not buying that one.
Paula's thing would be prepadutic. And I think Arnie was thinking about propadutic.
Yeah.
So
I agree
I'm
with
guessing.
Our captain. I agree with our captain.
You do, do you? Do you have any idea what he said?
This
actually?
Is what's known as good guest manners. Also, cover yourself.
Yes. What is the decision over there?
Well, we'll go with Caroline with the use of religious imagery.
Oh, I have a real problem
here.
Well,
this is the first time this has ever
happened. This is the first time this has happened. Of the two definitions I made up, that's the one I made up, but the other one's the correct one.
Yeah.
So,
points.
So now what? The introductory
course of the art of science.
No, I could have just killed you.
I had that hunch, didn't I?
Yeah.
Very good. The definition actually reads...
The definition says, propadeutic, an introductory or preparatory, which is misspelled here,
yes,
by the way,
sorry.
Course in art or science.
I noticed that as I was giving it to you. Very good. Let's go on to round three. Thomas Utterback of Seattle spends Saturday mornings listening to us on KUOW-FM. He's come up with a little number titled State the Obvious. Each of the following three-letter combinations can be found in two U.S. state names. For example, M-I-N
Minnesota.
Is found in Minnesota and also in Wyoming. A little less
Ooh.
Obvious.
Holy cow.
In which two states do each of the following triplets appear? Hmm. Carolyn, I-D-A.
Idaho.
Yes.
And Florida.
Idaho and Florida. Very good. This comes a little faster than you thought. Flash, try this. W-Y-O.
Oh, yeah. W-Y-O, of course, the first one would be Wyoming.
It would indeed.
And yeah. New York.
And New York is exactly right.
Oh,
very good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Good.
A little less obvious. Wyoming
I like it.
And
I get
New
it.
York.
I get it.
Okay.
Arnie,
yeah.
A-W-A.
Hawaii.
That's number one.
And?
Alabama.
I was wondering where the laugh was. There it is. You're only fighting the entire radio listening audience.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, come on. Guys.
Most of whom have the second one. That's why we do these categories. Give the folks at home a little.
West Virginia.
You have Hawaii.
Yeah.
Any help from that side?
California.
Yeah.
California.
Any help from the other side? Any help from the audience?
Delaware.
Oh. 5 points.
No, there's only 50. How hard could this be?
Yeah. Francine, O-N-T.
Don't say
Montana.
Ontario.
Montana.
Montana is the obvious.
And
Toronto's not a state.
No,
and neither is Ontario.
No.
Mont.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the other side just got it.
Vermont.
Vermont.
Vermont. Oh, just
excellent.
In under the wire. 10 points. Very good. Paula,
yeah.
Try this one. S-H-I.
S-H-I.
Washington.
Washington.
Washington is
not
correct.
Michigan. That's
not
a
Michigan.
C.
Washington and.
Yeah, Mississippi.
Washington.
Time is fast.
Oh, God.
Texas.
No.
The other side is writing furiously.
Oh, God.
New
Any
Mexico.
Any help up there? Any help from the other side? We go to the audience for
New Hampshire.
A chorus of voices, yes.
New Hampshire.
Is the other. 5 points for that effort. And finally, Barry, A-H-O.
Oh. A-H-O.
Idaho.
Idaho is the first.
And any thoughts there again?
Well, we're working on it.
Good question, Thomas.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma at the bell. Very good.
Oklahoma.
Yes.
You went home.
Yeah.
Oklahoma.
Thank you,
That's a good round, Thomas. Thank you. Let's go on to round four, which is Barry's team's chance to have a little fun at Webster's expense. One of you will correctly define the following word. Two will bluff. 10 points, Paula, if your team can find the rose among thorns. Take a few seconds to come up with a definition for the word. First time we've been to Q in a while. Quirkin. Q-U-E-R-K-E-N, quirkin. Gentlemen.
Really
yeah.
If you want to eat up hours of free time that otherwise could be spent ironing or changing the washers in the basement sink, why not check out our website at www.sayu.org. That's S-A-Y-S-Y-O-U, all one word. You can ask us questions, contribute questions, order books, CDs, tickets, or simply fall asleep with your cheek on the keyboard. Everything in good fun at www.sayu.org.
The mighty, mighty Dactyls. Thank you, guys, for giving us a little time with the word quirkin. We will go first to Flash.
Quirkin. I believe that quirkin is an old English term from which is derived the term croak, actually. It means, it's a verb, actually. It means to choke or throttle an adversary.
To choke or throttle an adversary?
Because you wouldn't do it to your friend.
That's right.
Choke and throttle. Francine Quirkin.
Quirkin are Dutch porcelain decorative figurines.
Not to be taken internal.
You have problems in the audience with Dutch
figurines? Why is that funny?
Yeah, I don't know.
Rather like Hummel figures are well known in Germany. Quirkin are well known in Holland.
I have a sudden urge to throttle figurines.
Well, they're not everybody's taste, but some people little Quirkin. China tchotchke things, right.
Made of chocolate.
Dutch figurines. Barry.
A quirkin is a short, round-bladed knife used for close combat. It's familiar to fans of Shakespeare's Scottish play when Macbeth cries, "There shall be a terrible hurtin' when I start jerking my quirkin."
So that's what he meant by that.
Yeah. No, Barry, so, would you read the beginning of yours again?
No, don't even bother. It's a short, rounded knife.
Round-bladed.
Oh, I'm sorry, a short, round...
A quirkin is a short, round-bladed knife used for close combat.
A short, rounded, blade, round-bladed knife, a Dutch figurine, or to choke and throttle.
I thought a quirkin sounded like an eccentric pickle.
Yeah, it does.
Now, this is the second time Flash has gone to Old English.
I know.
Except... Oh. This time, he might
but
have
But I think
something.
It's a noun. I don't think it's a
Do
verb
you?
Form, quirkin. It's really? Just a feeling that I have.
Figurines.
Figurines. Dutch figurines. Quirkin. This doesn't sound like it's
I actually it sound like it's received from a Dutch intern a small
a whole box of
porcelain house. As a way of thanking me for an internship.
And you think...
Do I have a clue whether it had a name?
Yeah. Did it say that?
No.
Here's your quirkin, thanks.
No. He just said, this is a traditional... This is very traditional in Holland, and this is a traditional gift. But I have no idea. So, but I'm the captain, and I have to decide.
Yes.
Thanks for sharing.
Okay, what do you guys think?
I don't know.
I would probably go with... Flash, because I think that Barry said a quirkin is a knife, and I think it sounds like other knife-like terms.
Pizza cutter.
But I think it's...
So you're going counterintuitive. We need a decision, unfortunately.
Right. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Paula.
I think I'll say it's Barry's.
Oh.
Really?
Barry...
Gee, I thought you were going the other way.
She thinks it's a short, round-bladed knife.
Quirkin says, please make up a definition.
There you go.
As well you did, 10 points. Very good. Who might have been telling the truth over there?
Flash.
Quirkin, to grab about another's throat with both hands and shake and choke.
Yeah.
Very good, 10 points. A good bluff. That's why we stay away from Q, actually. Let's go on to round 5. David Dixon of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, listens on WHAD-FM. He's come up with a round of presidential... and wannabe presidential anagrams.
Anagrams.
Please rearrange the letters in the following clues to reveal a presidential name. Carolyn, love laconic, dig. LoveLaconic.
Oh, it was Lincoln.
Comma, dig.
Scramble.
And this is, look
scramble.
At the clue.
So this is the first and last name.
Silent Cal, Calvin Coolidge?
Calvin Coolidge is exactly right. 10 points. That's how you play the game.
Wait a minute.
Love laconic, the clue being laconic, Silent Cal.
Yes.
Very good, Calvin Coolidge.
Oh, I see. Wow. That's wild. Okay.
Say that?
Got it. Okay.
Flash, try this. With law, Lord, am I fat.
With law?
Loft.
With law...
L-A-W?
Yes.
Taft?
Oh.
William Howard Taft?
William Howard Taft, that's right.
William Howard Taft is exactly right.
Right.
The clue, of course, being the girth of the situation. Yes. Arnie, try this one. Loin, L-O-I-N, comma.
Comma.
Calm till win, C-A-L-M-T-I-L.
Wait a minute. Calm, C-A-L-M.
Yep.
Yeah.
Till, T-I-L.
Yeah.
Win, W-I-N. Loin calm till win.
Loin?
Ooh, in the audience.
Loin?
Calm till...
Any thoughts from that side?
Looks like a blank slate. Any thoughts on the other side?
It's William somebody, huh?
Clinton? Well,
that's exactly right.
There you go.
Loin. Loin calm right, till win is William Clinton. Which I think we've covered sufficiently, don't you? Let's go quickly on. Francine, the unsuccessful candidate for the presidency whose name scrambles Sore Sport.
Sore Sport.
The unsuccessful candidate for presidency whose name scrambles Sore Sport.
Well, there's no Al Gore in there. There's no Richard Nixon in there.
No.
What are the letters again?
Sore.
Sore Sport. SoreSport.
Oh.
Ooh, the other side knows. I think the time is up.
Okay.
We go to the other side.
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot is exactly right.
Yes.
Sore Sport decodes as Ross Perot. Paula, GIs divided, he won the war.
GIs.
GI, apostrophe S,
divided,
comma, Eisenhower. He won the war.
Oh,
Dwight Eisenhower.
Dwight
David Eisenhower is correct. 10 points.
Okay.
And finally, Barry, this one's tough. Insane Anglo warlord.
We've had that as a president?
Insane Anglo warlord.
No.
I'm sure we're not going to win points with whatever library we're insulting at this moment.
No.
Who was president during the Spanish American?
No, it's not that one, actually.
No.
That looks like a blank slate. The other side, do you have any thoughts?
No.
Not good
we're
ones.
Wrong.
Any thoughts from the audience?
George Washington.
No, actually, it's Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Reagan. Ronald.
Oh, that's not insulting.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good clue.
Let's go home now. Yes, Ronald Wilson Reagan. I don't know where that... Oh, it came from David Dixon of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, thank goodness. The score is a total loss, so I'm going to presume the right to award this week's contest to Miss Paula Lyons. Congratulations, Paula. That is all we have time for this week. My colleague with Quill and Query is Mr. Philip Salkin, Oleart and Mattis, Man the Meters. Once every few weeks, we remind you that this show is best when we get your questions, when we get your comments, and most of all, when you show up. See you next week.
Says You is the co-creation of WGBH Radio and Pippin and Finch, Boston. Funding for Says You is provided by this and other NPR member stations and studio products, art materials from alum to zinc oxide for the serious artist, on the web at www.studioproducts.com. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. www.pewtrusts.com. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.